Okay, we're recording. This is Paulina McDougall. I'm in Hal Bourne's office on campus at the University of Maine in the Climate Change Institute. It's June 24th, I think?
25th,
2013. I'm here with Hal Bourne and Adam Cheely, who's a grad assistant. And we're going to be talking about the history of the Climate Change Institute, which, when you began, was the Quaternary Institute.
Yeah.
So I'd like to actually ask you a little bit about your own background, how you became interested in geology, and how you ended up starting out on this career in the beginning.
Oh, it's a fairly easy study. I came out of the military after World War II as an electronics technician, and I went to work for Bell Telephone for a while, putting up microwave towers around New England, doing the instrumentation in them. And my father kept saying, you better go to college, because someday someone's going to come along in the Bell company that doesn't know as much as you do, but they've got a degree, and they're going to get the job, and you're not. Just as simple as that. And so I believed him finally, and I had the GI Bill. So I went to Tufts as an undergraduate, mostly because my father was a graduate of that. He knew people, and he said, "This, you know, liberal arts school, that's what I wanted." But I started out in electrical engineering. And after a while, like all engineering schools, they make the students take courses that humanize them a little bit. There's probably a little bit less than that now. But I had an array of electives, and I took geology. I said, what in heaven's name is this? And it's being taught by my father's old roommate in college, a guy named Bob Nichols. So that's what I did. And I sat through, and the thing that turned me on was the sequence of rock events in the Grand Canyon from the top to the bottom, or the bottom to the top, and the fact that each layer was an entirely different environment. And we have, I remember them to this day, Kaibab, Coconino, Supai, and Redwall. Redwall, I learned them backwards from what I normally would do, but the bottom was an ocean limestone overlain by riverine deposits, so you had to get out of the ocean, overlain by windblown sand, big sandstone, dunes, overlain by a marine limestone. And so I was absolutely fascinated with that. That's what did it. I said, that's the end of the engineering. And as I found out, the engineering at Tufts at that time, I didn't really look into it. And it was a big power transmission generation systems rather than the details of electronics, which you handle with a microscope sometimes and little welding tools and, you know, things like that, which I was used to doing, the innards of radios and things, which is all changed today, of course. But so that was it, and I just stayed with it. I got out of school. I didn't know what to do. I tried different things, and tried teaching for a while.
Where did you teach?
At a private school called Tabor Academy at Marion, Mass. I tried working with the U.S. Geological Survey for one summer as a field assistant in Maryland. And finally, I became a geological field assistant in marine geology at the University of Rhode Island. And I finally decided that I really wanted to do something in the field. So I applied to graduate school to Boston University. And I continued to do that and do bedrock geology. And I slowly got more interested in the surface geology and did that, and then decided, where can I go to get the best education in surface geology? Was Richard Foster Flint at Yale University. So I wrote to him, said, can I come and spend a couple of years with you guys? And he said, sure, come along. So I went to Yale, and there I am. Took a job at Maine. It was such a great place, I just never wanted to leave. I still don't. I think it's a wonderful school.
So.
And the best part of, well, I shouldn't, I'll say it. Best part of it is they were so loosely controlled here that you could do anything you damn well pleased to do, whereas the older, more set universities, it would be almost impossible to build an institute like we did.
Yeah, so you found sort of fertile ground for your creativity here.
Yeah, yeah.
And glaciers, how did that come into the picture?
Glaciers? Well, here I was here in New England. I'd never been in cold regions. In the military, I was in island hopping in South Pacific and Iwo Jima and things like that. And I just started getting interested in that map, for example, with Eskers all over it. And
the map of Maine.
I didn't know anything about it, and I started to get interested. That's when I really got interested. But it was finishing up the doctoral dissertation in bedrock geology in the Skowhegan region of Maine, right in the middle of the Appalachian Mountain System, that I really started to get interested in the terraces of the Kennebec Valley and other things like that, which are glacial. I said, that's what I want to do. Fascinated with glaciers.
So you came to the university when?
1955.
And the department was a geology department?
No. geology, believe it or not, was the first course ever taught at the University of Maine. It was taught downtown in one of the town office buildings in 1867 or so. Just because the university was a committee when it was formed, and that's all it was. But anyways, it's been taught in geography, as geography has been taught as agronomy, soil, mostly related to the agricultural field with different names, soils, and so forth. Well, eventually, it never was a department, and when I joined, geology as such, as we know it today, was taught in the civil engineering department, but not from an engineering point of view. All we did was teach a course called Geology for Engineers, and we taught another one called Geology for Foresters. They were sort of day in and day out, kind of. It wasn't engineering geology, it was geology for engineers. Well, most of our students actually were in the Arts and Science College in a traditional way, and we were a department. A very small department, and it remained stable for 4 or 5 years. The positions were the same subject-wise, but the people changed in and out of those positions for a while. So eventually,
were there other geologists here besides yourself? Were there other geologists
yes,
here then?
The head man was Joseph Trefethen, was a structural geologist. We had an economic geologist named Larry Wing. Mrs. Trefethen was a paleontologist, and me teaching glacial geology. And these were the courses that were taught for many years under Joe Trefethen, who was the head. And at that time, it wasn't a democratic society. He could hire and fire people. You didn't have to go through the falter all that we go through anymore. So that's the way he wanted it. So I replaced a man who had taught glacial geology, and he had replaced another one that had taught glacial geology. So the subjects stayed the same for many years, but people came and went within the framework. Well, so we finally became a separate department. I've forgotten the date. It's in that listing. And by that time, the idea of a dictator type of department head, we went to a rotating chairmanship, and we voted to elect Philip Osberg, who's around still. I mean, he's in bad shape physically. But Phil took over, and he he had come here from Harvard and then Pennsylvania, the University of Pennsylvania, and he knew what the world was about, and a really, really good geologist, and a hard rock, interested in the structure of the Appalachian Mountain system. And he set the stage. He wasn't wet behind the ears right out of graduate school. He had his own ideas, and he said, what we need to do, what we'd like to do, is have a department that's known because it has a firm research field and a firm teaching field. And that's what we want to be known as. And the dean at the time was John Knowlton. No, it wasn't. Can't think of his name. He said, that's fine, within the College of Arts and Sciences. And Phil said, let's break out teaching and research on the financial level. And so it's in writing that 70% this, 70%, 50% that, you know, that's what they, mm-hmm. And they couldn't do it because, well, they wouldn't, no, they couldn't do it because of the nature of the money and where money came from. And so, and they were frightened to do it because the population might say, I thought we were teaching people to teach. We're not teaching people, we're not paying people to do research. You know, they were afraid that if we became, if we looked like a non-teaching, full-time, 100%, the legislature wouldn't treat us very well.
That's
there was a real fright about that.
That's interesting because this is a land-grant institution which has a research.
Yeah, but there's a difference.
Mission.
You know, I got the first NSF grant on this campus, and I may have told you this, but it was 1965. It was $15,000 to work on the terraces of the Kennebec River, and I got the award. NSF had just been formed after Sputnik. The United States said, we got to do something, and so they started to do non-mission related research, like NSF does. Is, you know, mission, NASA will say, we're going to do a study of X, Y, and Z, submit a proposal to do X, Y, and Z. That's mission related.
Right.
This is anything you want type of research. So they didn't have an organization to put it in, so they put it in the Office of Naval Research as a vehicle. That then evolved into the National Science Foundation. So, anyways, about that, that's when I applied. I found an ad in the paper, in a,
really?
in a book, in a journal, something, a geological journal. So I did, and I got it, and I took it to the treasurer of the university, and I asked him, as I was directed by NSF, asked him for an account, and we'll transfer the money to the account. I went to the treasurer, a man named Prescott Vos. And he looked at me and he said, what can I do for you? And I said, I got this money from the National Science Foundation. I need an account to spend it out of. And he said, you mean you asked the government to support your research? And I said, yeah. He said, that's tainted money. You shouldn't do this. And he refused to give me an account. He wouldn't give me
that
an account.
That is incredible.
And so I put it in the bank. In the Merrill Trust, which doesn't exist anymore.
In your own pocket.
And furthermore, NSF called me and said, you know, you forgot to put in overhead money. And so they said, go over to the business office and tell them that, and because there's some money that will come to the university directly for cost of lights. So I did that, and he said, I don't know anything about that. He said, if you want to negotiate that, why don't you go down to the federal building in Boston and do it for the university? I said, I'm not going to do that. I went back to NSF and told them. And they said, we already negotiated it with the University of Maine, and he doesn't know it. So then I got them to pull out the paperwork, and they got some money. But that was the story of the first grant. So I went back and said, I was sort of a little bit awed by administrators at that time. I shouldn't have been. I was 25 years old. So he, and I've killed a few Japanese people in the meantime. I'm not very proud of that, but you know, I shouldn't have been backward, at least. So I said, Mr. Vose, you get money from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to support the experiment station, don't you? Yes. You get McIntyre, that's called hatch money, and you get McIntyre Stennis money to support forestry, and that's agriculture money, that's federal money. Is that tainted money? And he said, of course not. He said, that's what this university does. We don't do your kind of research.
Well, I'm amazed that you persevered through all that.
Isn't that amazing?
Yes.
Absolutely amazing. That then became a transition when we formed this institute. That was the end of the domination of agriculture here on the campus.
Really? In the 70s?
It had to be. And President Libby knew it. Because we were the first research, university-funded research organization on the campus outside of agriculture. And he took a lot of heat for that, I found out afterwards. And I didn't know this. I didn't even think about that. But that's what it was. He saw the handwriting on the wall. And
that's incredible. What is that noise?
And it's the air conditioning system. And to this day, as far as I know, the institute has brought in something like $38
million. Is that right? $38
million.
Yeah. That's extraordinary.
Added it up one day.
Yeah. Starting with that $15,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But $15,000 went a long way.
There was no research and sponsored programs organization back then.
No, nothing.
Yeah.
No signatures. No. You didn't have to do anything.
Yeah.
But
simpler.
In the meantime, when we elected Phil Osberg, the chairman, Joe Trefethen was so incensed, he left the university and went to Portland, which the University of Southern Maine reported to us. He went down there and ended his career down there. But then how are we going to make research time? The only way to do it is to combine the big... I'm sorry, big beginning course that we had. Everybody taught beginning geology, 25 in a room at one time. So I was teaching two sections of beginning geology 3 days a week. And that took a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And so we combined all of that and put it in Hauk Auditorium. And I got the job of teaching it. It was a total disaster. It's the first time this campus had ever had anything that big. I won't go into all the problems, but immediately you can't use a slide projector. That's one thing. So where do you get the overheads being produced on a daily basis? Well, we had a place in education that did that, but they weren't geared up to this kind of pressure every day. And then I couldn't speak to anybody because who are we going to talk to? You know, back and forth, no give or take. So I tried experiments. And then the other side of it, at that time, all teachers had to take attendance. And at the end of the session, when you recorded grades and turned them in, you had to report the attendance.
Really?
Yeah, and the reason for that was, I was told, that when some guy calls up and says, my son Johnny failed, and the dean says, well, he missed 15 lectures, what do you expect?
Yeah.
Well, so we finally had to get to the dean, and I said, Dean, we teach that course or we take attendance. We don't do both. You can't do it. And we have no assistance. So what do we do? And that basically ended the business of taking attendance.
How many students did you have?
600.
That's a large class.
I tried. I won't go into it very far, but I finally decided that if you asked a question in a group that big, they wouldn't answer. So and no attendance was taken, so I didn't know where anybody sat. So I said, I'm just going to pick out 10 names randomly off the list and leave the front row open. And I want those people to come up every day, the new one I read off, and sit in the front. Now we'll carry on a discussion that way, and then it'll be different tomorrow and different next day. Well, it didn't work. I called the names up and no one came up. And they knew I didn't know where they were anyways. So it's just great complexities developed out of that thing. And now these things are pretty well straightened out on the campus. We can do things like that. But at that time, it was the transition into that kind of teaching was rather difficult, to say the least. Yeah.
So you had always had small classes before that?
Yeah, 25.
Yeah, that's a nice
usually in, over in Boardman Hall. And we repeat them, you know. And that wasn't very good because Joe Trefethen was very lax and we never coordinated things. So this group under him was getting one thing, this group under me was getting something else. And Phil Osberg taught physical, historical geology, and we never got out of the Precambrian,
you know? Yeah, exactly.
But anyways, so that's the way it went. And then we decided that about the same time that we became a department, that was one of the things we had to do. And then we want to specialize in something so that we're competitive for research funds at the national level and for students. What are we going to specialize in? Well, Phil Osberg was a structural geologist. Well, we can't do that. Harvard's got that field sold up. MIT does, Yale does. We can't do that. We tried all the fields. We all explored the fields. And my field, I went to Washington and went to the National Academy and asked them, is this a good time in American science to go into quaternary stuff? And they all said yes, because it's becoming apparent that we live in a world dominated by quaternary climate history. Mm-hmm.
And
the National Science Foundation takes its lead from what the National Academy says. They'll write a white paper and then there's some steering in here, but not to the level of mission related. But so they said, yes, we're going to fund this. And but both of them said, if you're going to do it, though, you have to do it by going at it from a multidisciplinary viewpoint, and you have to do it right now.
Yeah.
That was the word. And I came back. That's what we decided to do. President Libby bought it, and off we went.
Now, how was quaternary defined at that time?
Quaternary? Well, you know the geological time scale.
Right.
You got the whole Precambrian. The first 2 billion years of Earth history is there. But then it becomes the Paleozoic, which starts at 500 million, Mesozoic, that starts at 200 million, the Cenozoic, which is at 60 million, and we're a subdivision of that, which is basically the Ice Age. And that's called the Quaternary.
So is it 1 million, 2 million?
2.5 million.
2.5, thank you.
The way it is now. And it's defined by the time when the big ice sheets reached the mid-latitudes.
Okay.
That's how it's defined.
The maximum glaciation.
Yeah, not on the climate change or anything, but when those big glaciers reach the mid-latitudes, then that's the time. There are several definitions.
This is when it begins?
Yeah, that's when the quaternary begins.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the definition.
So everything post, everything after that is
quaternary. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Including the present.
Yeah, yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
I just wanted
those
to get
are
that
subdivisions
on record
of the quaternary.
People in the future listening to this might not understand.
Yeah, and then we break it down into the with a quaternary and recent. Well, recent is meaningless, you know. It's the time since the ice left, and how do you do that? You know, these are just man-made lines, but they're lines that you can measure, actually get out and stand on and measure,
right,
and that's
right.
Why it's done that way. One of the ways, the earlier definition of quaternary was when the cold water moved down from the north, the cold North Atlantic, got into the Pennsylvanian, and reached the toe of Italy at a place called Calabria. And at that point in the cliffs that are up, you have warm water shells and all of a sudden instantly cold water shells. And that line was the demarcation for the beginning of the quaternary.
How do you define cold water?
Well, they were Arctic shells.
Okay.
Yeah, that sort of thing compared to tropical shells.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
There was a lot of you know, a lot of different ways. And then eventually the radiometric dating systems came along, which allowed us to put real dates on.
Mm-hmm.
You could go out and say, you know, here's the edge of the ice. It's Long Island, New York. But how old is it? You know. So anyways, that's what we did. But we decided that we were not going to worry about quaternary as they would do it in Arizona or New Mexico. And we weren't going to do it as far as the marine world. We were going to do it in the northern ice world. And that was the specialty, with a foot into the marine stuff and maybe a foot into the areas to the south one way or the other, but primarily it's there. And then I decided, and everybody agreed, we need two people in all fields so that there's an overlap and one can be away and the other one is here. So there are two people like me, George Denton and myself. There are two archaeologists, there always have been, two paleontologists, George Davis, you know, George
Ron.
And Ron Davis. So that's the way it was done. And we had a little step into the marine world. We had a glaciologist. That was the other thing we had to have, just a single glaciologist. And that's what we did.
So you started out with about six people.
Yeah.
Now we're up to...
They weren't all at once, because it's a good thing. If they had, as President Libby said, we're going to do this in concept, and every time we get enough money, we'll give it to you. But don't expect everything at once, and that's a good thing, because each person that came aboard then integrated with the rest of us to find the next guy or woman. You know, that's the way it went. We had a case here. We got the first EBSCOR grant on the campus in geology, and it was a dead failure. Hired about five people all at once, and after they were all here, they didn't talk to each other. They left. They did. The whole thing collapsed because
the collegiality wasn't there.
It was a social thing. You know?
Yeah.
So we did it the right way by accident, pure accident. Yeah.
Well, I think it was more than an accident. I mean, I think that your vision and personality had a lot to do with the success.
Well, yeah.
You were able to find people that you knew were going to work well.
They had to be compatible.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a little friction here and there between George Jacobson and Ron Davis. They didn't get along too well, but well enough. But that was the only friction that we really had, I think. And that wasn't a serious one at all.
Yeah.
And we had Rob Onnickson, which caused a big commotion for a while. But, you know,
well, there was gonna be
pay your money and take the chances on some of these.
Exactly.
As long as you have the control to hire and fire is what's important.
Yeah. Now, when did you retire?
From the Institute?
Yeah.
I would say about 1988?
No.
As director.
Oh, okay.
And
but you were still
And
working.
I went to Washington to run polar glaciology for the NSF.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I actually retired in 2004.
2004, from the university.
I would have retired a little bit earlier, but I had no intention of retiring, but I didn't. It was a time when we'd get something going to find someone new, and then they canned the whole search because they didn't have enough money. And that's the way I want. I want to make absolutely sure that we don't lose the position.
Mm.
Of all positions to lose, you don't want to lose a glacial geologist in
in
an institute like this.
Yeah.
And that could have happened quite easily. So I just waited until it was absolutely done before I actually retired.
So how has your own research contributed to the Institute's mission and goals?
Well, all right. I had an attitude that that my job, no matter what, was teaching and research. There's no question about it. That's the way I was hired. Albeit they expect... Oh, one of the comments, by the way, when Joe Trefethen learned that I had gotten this grant from NSF, this is the department boss, he said, you shouldn't have done that. He said, you shouldn't ask the government to fund your research. It's your job to do it, but you shouldn't ask for the government. It's just the same attitude as, and he said, I said, well, Joe, how are you going to do it otherwise? I said, he said, well, he said, you do it on your own income. And he said, if you do it on your own income, you'll suffer a little bit, and so will your family, but you'll be a better person for it later. And you'll learn economy that way. I mean, honestly, I couldn't believe it. No. But anyways, so the point being that I told the group if I was going to be the director, I was going to continue to do research, because I realized that if you didn't in an organization like this, you immediately lose contact with everybody. They're all doing their thing and talking to each other.
Yeah.
You're standing here on the sideline doing nothing except paperwork. And you lose your respectability within a faculty if you don't do that.
Right.
And you lose it in another way if you don't teach. Because you can have a whole research organization that comes and goes, and the teaching faculty doesn't know anything about it. So we had to be a teaching research organization. Look, my objective was to make it look like a department, but not be a department. Make it look like one. And that's how you get the support of the faculty in general when you need it, the big faculty when you need it. So I told them I couldn't do all things for everybody at once. I've got to do research. I'm going to be gone. Some things will fall on the side of the road. I may assign you to follow through with the dean, do something like that, but not me. And you've got to put up with that. And they agreed. That's the way that went.
So I know you've done research in this state. Where else have you?
Yeah, the other thing I felt for my whole career was that I'm part of the University of Maine, and I should have a continuous program on doing research in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done that. I'm still doing it.
Yeah.
Although I'm presently working in Ireland, but I'm still working on down East Maine and
mm-hmm.
other places. I've worked all over the state. But it's hard to raise money to work in Maine, you know.
I know.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to do it through NSF, but you can't. You've got to make it look exciting to NSF, to the reviewers. And so that's been a little bit of a difficult thing to do. But then I decided that I was going to do other things too. And so being a Norwegian, I have an adventurous background, I guess, gene in me. So I started to work in different parts of the world. But one of the things I wanted to work in is Antarctica, because I wanted to see what one of these big glaciers does. And I also worked in the Yukon for a couple of summers on a valley glacier just to see what the valley glacier did. And out of it came some pretty good papers, but
right.
little ice age papers. But
yeah.
That's how I got to know what a glacier was all about.
Mm-hmm.
By
so when did you go to
sleeping
Antarctica?
Next to them.
When did you go to Antarctica?
1960.
Oh, that was early.
29 times.
Who did you go with?
Tufts University. I got invited. The International Geophysical Year started in 1958. It went in the field in the Antarctic in 1959, and it continued until 1961 or two. And the IGY, you know, it was, if you were worried about Earth magnetism, in that one, the idea was to do all the physical measurements of the whole Earth in 1 year and integrate it. Well, if you're working in Europe and you're measuring magnetism, you can do it. But if the minute you start to talk about the Antarctic, and the question there was the size, magnitude, and the activity of the ice sheet, that's all it was, it takes you a year to get the thing set up in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So it continued, IGY continued for three or four years, and
now,
I was part
IGY
of that.
IGY stands for?
International Geophysical Year.
Okay.
In which the geophysical scientists of the world measure everything geophysical.
Okay.
And so my former professor at Tufts said, Hal, how would you like to go with us as my field assistant? So I did, with three other people. George Denton was one of them. He was a student at Tufts at that time. I had already had a PhD. and there were a couple more people that, from Tufts that came down at different times, and because we were there for 3 months, long
haul. Tell me what that was like going there for the first time. Tell me what was that was like going there for the first time.
Every day was an adventure. What do we do now? Type, you know. But Bob Nichols had been there before the previous year and just did a little bit of, I mean, the last science that was done by the Scott Expedition in 1912, you know.
Right.
And and George Denton had been as one of his field assistants at that time. So George had been there for 1 year. And it was just very exciting. New things. I learned how to camp, and I learned how to be a good expeditionist, and we learned how to man haul sleds and go places where no one had ever been, and we didn't think anybody would ever come back again, because the idea was when IGY was over, that's the end of the Antarctic. But what came out of that was so spectacular that the program has continued as the U.S. Antarctic program since then.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the beginning of it, and I didn't go back to the Antarctic for several years, and then I decided I'm going to focus in and do some more work down there. In the meantime, I'd been working in the Yukon and Norway and Sweden.
But what were some of the special challenges of working in an environment like that in terms of doing
the biggest research? The biggest challenge at that time was that it was a completely unknown area. Scientifically, hardly known at all.
Yeah.
But the field conditions were not known except from the early expedition reports and things like that. And so the biggest problem is to learn how to live and do science at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You could spend your whole damn day living, you know.
Yeah. Did you have any special problems with equipment or anything of that sort?
They had problems. The support force for the sciences was the Navy. It's not now. It's totally a civilian. In fact, I was thinking I might apply to go down and help on that end of it next year, just for the fun of it. But the at that time, the Navy helicopters that we needed were really apprehensive about flying too far away from Mother Base. You know, they wouldn't go into the dry valleys 200 miles from McMurdo. They were very cautious about doing much, you know. So they...
How did you get around?
By foot.
You walked?
Yeah, we walked. Yeah.
Snowshoes?
Huh?
Snowshoes?
No, as a matter of fact, I was just looking at something. Let me show you something. These are expedition photos that I've had over the years. It used to be on the wall. They're all faded.
Gee, how would you let us scan? Would you let us scan some of those for the collection?
These are all Antarctic. They're all dirty. I haven't looked at these for a long time. I had them overboard, and I'll never put them back up again. But this is 1960, 60, 61. That's George Denton. This is the guy, and this is how we live. We have two tents like this.
Yep.
And that's it, you know. And no snow. It's called the Dry Valley area. The ice came down through the whole area. But as we moved into the present world, the ice melted back and never came into the valley. So they're big glaciated valleys, but the big inland ice sheet is way back up, you can see it. But, you know, we had all, we're on our feet, that's all.
So and, would it be okay for us to scan these?
Sure.
To keep in the collection? Because I think this would be very interesting.
It's filthy.
And besides, they may, as you know, fade.
These are Antarctic pictures. This is from...
What's this one?
This is from 60-61. It's the same thing.
Yep.
This is from much later, 1977.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Norton.
It's nice that you have the labels, too. We can...
Yeah. This is a much better picture of this. This, it's upstairs. This is a big picture. It's this big. And it belonged to Bob Nichols, who is this guy. That's me. That's George Denton. And these are two other people that you don't know. This is Brad Hall. His name is Brown, Steve Brown. He runs Brown Goldsmithing Company in Freeport. Wonderful shop. And the other one is a dean of oceanography at the University of Florida at the present time. But, you know, so it's just a matter of living. And almost all my work was in the glaciated valleys because that's where the record is. But then in the last 2 or 3 years that I worked there, we were working out on the ice sheet on mountaintops, sticking up through to get the former level of the ice sheet, mm-hmm. like the ring around the bathtub, you know, around the mountain. And we worked central west Antarctica, right in the middle of the ice sheet, and then up towards the pole, a couple hundred miles from the South Pole, doing the same thing. And that's the last time I worked there, because I discovered I had a heart problem and it's got fixed, but they wouldn't let me back.
That's too bad.
That's it. I don't have the problem.
Let me ask you something about this.
Yeah.
You were obviously aware of earlier explorations, not necessarily scientific even, but, well, they could be considered scientific, but did you think of yourself as an explorer?
No, not really. Every once in a while it would cross my mind that, you know, I'm the only person that ever been here.
Yeah.
You know, walking around these valleys. And probably no one else will ever be here. And I got those kind of feelings. Today, if you go down there, people tell me that they have come from this time but have worked in recent years. The time scale has shifted somewhat. And they said, you guys work down there like you're a bunch of cowboys compared to today. We're so tightly controlled on everything we do. It's just like living in a city at McMurdo, and there's not that excitement of discovery anymore.
Now when you go and work in other countries like Ireland or Norway, how do you develop relationships there so that you can go and work there?
Well, what I've been doing is, I am a Norwegian by definition, and that's not the reason. But I pick projects that would give me a glacial record in the least fairly recent times that has a climate history to it.
Mm-hmm.
So the Younger Dryas has a wonderful record in Scandinavia. Then we started to look at things like the surface water temperatures in the North Atlantic throughout the deglacial period by working in Greenland, Iceland, Norway, and Denmark. And that project is done. So we've got a long history of changing surface water temperatures in the North Atlantic. This project in Ireland is about an ice sheet that existed off the west coast that no one of us had seen before.
Uh-huh.
And this is sort of a fun project, but it also contributes a new mass of ice to the global sea level problems. And also, it's a marine-based ice sheet, which no one would ever...
Is it
20 years
now?
Ago, yeah, it's all gone. Uh-huh. It sat out here off this coast in here, out here, and flowed onto land for a while. That's how I discovered it. Accidentally, I was over in a, it was a kind of a funny reason, but that's how it went. And so I worked with the Geological Survey of Ireland for a while, and they provided maps and stuff like that. And I'm still doing it. I'm just trying to figure out if I've got to go back to Ireland this summer for a week. But so the projects have, and the main projects are the same way. Working on the Pineal Ridge system down east, we've, with the Geological Survey, we've extended the Pineal Ridge re-advance, which is the precursor of global warming. All of a sudden, there's an enormous air temperature rise following that, and the ice sheet hooped out completely almost. Yeah. And so that's a big deal. And we traced that margin all the way from St. John, New Brunswick now to the New Hampshire Maine border down towards north of Portland. So that's the same thing. It's the same idea. And every once in a while I'll get involved in something that's absolutely useless to anybody.
What do you think has been, let's say, most the biggest contribution of the Climate Change Institute or the Quaternary Institute?
Yeah. I don't know.
What do you think?
I guess the worst, the probably the work in West Antarctica, the last kind of work I did. Excuse me. It's not contagious, it's pollen. And also, I think all the work in Maine, I think I made a big contribution to Maine, because when I came here, the last work was done in 1930, that map right there. That was all there was. And there was no radiocarbon dates, nothing. And I just started in saying to myself, where can I work in Maine that will give us the best, quickest, dirtiest view of the Ice Age history? And I thought about it a long time, and I decided the Kennebec Valley, because it was a sluice way to melt water. And whatever that ice sheet was doing, it had to drain water through the melt water, through that big channel area of the Kennebec, and particularly from North Anson, from Skowhegan northward, is full of wonderful terraces. So you've got terrace levels and all sorts of things. And so that was the first thing we ever did. And then I roped in Menzie Stiver down at Yale, a radiocarbon guy, and we took on the marine submergence of the state, because it had been earlier people saying, well, how long is it? Was the water over the state for 20 years, 100 years, 2,000 years? Was the ice, was it up against the ice? Yes, no, yeah. When was it? No, yeah. And so we took it on.
What did you find out?
2 weeks, we wrote a paper on the marine submergence. The ice receded with the water up against it. We dated it. Shells at the bottom of the marine sediment, shells at the top of the marine sediment, peat bogs on the top. We spent 2 weeks a summer for about five summers doing this. Camping. Take the families and go camping and just go do this. And so we, two of us, defined the marine submergence of the state for the first time.
Yeah. And how long was it submerged?
About 1,000 years.
About 1,000.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. But there must have been places that were above water.
It started in over the coast at 13,000 radiocarbon years, went all the way inland, and drained back to the coast by 12,000. So the marine clay at the coast is 13 at the bottom, 12 at the top, then it turns into beaches. So in and out, 1,000 years. Of course, that reflects global sea level, the interface of global sea level and land level changes.
Right.
So anyways, those are the things I've been doing.
Thank you for that. I have just a couple more questions, and then we'll finish up. There's a lot of debate in the political arena about climate change and so on.
Yeah.
What's your perspective on all of that?
Well, yeah, that's, I thing people think about all the time. I guess there are two ways to look at it. There's belief, and then there's scientific fact. And sometimes there's a mixture of those two things. But I can tell you, I can believe that's a raging bull on the other side of that wall, and no one can prove that it isn't or is. You know, you can't argue effectively with belief. You can argue with scientific stuff. And the way science works, of course, as you know, you gather information, put it together, draw a conclusion, find a new piece of evidence, put it in there, put it all together, draw a new conclusion, da 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 da.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, the Earth is warming, you know. There's no question about it. And it's so simple to see this, because if you look at the global atmospheric temperatures for as far back as we have records, into the 1600s, it's done nothing but get warmer. The record is clear as a bell, you know. Just like this, just clear as a bell. There it is. And what is, how do you say it isn't happening, you know? The other thing, if you look at the glaciers of the world, which are climate sensitive, every single glacier in the world, except maybe one or two, is melting.
Mm-hmm.
How do you say no, it isn't? And then the satellites going around through the atmosphere, looking down at the top of the atmosphere, say the global atmosphere is warming, and it has been ever since we have measurements. So if you put it all together, you can't avoid the fact that it's getting warmer. You know,
right.
You just can't do it.
Have you been involved in any policy discussions or?
No, I try to stay out of them.
Yeah.
And then the clear records of things that we have, the frost-free data, you know. Well, the CO carbon dioxide cycles. The record is, if the CO2 increases, the temperature increases. That's all there is to it. That's a clear-cut record. You can't say the CO2 goes up, but the temperature does not. The record is that it does. You know, there's a lot of graphs showing this. One, you've got the CO2 level in the atmosphere, and then above it you get the temperature that follows it just exactly. Yeah. Measured stuff. And one of the questions comes, of course, does what role do humans? Well, then you look at the CO2 cycles, for example, and they go chomp, 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 chomp. And then you get to 1780, 1750, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and all of a sudden the CO2 goes way up here. And there isn't a level like that for the past measurably 630,000 years.
Now that's primarily from coal.
Yeah, yeah.
And is there a difference between, I mean, does the CO2 coming from the northern hemisphere also affect the southern hemisphere?
Yeah, it does.
It does.
It must.
So it just goes out there.
It's global. It's just like you set off an atomic bomb in downtown Bangor, if you're going to get it in South America. You know, remember the old movie called On the Beach? At that time, they thought it would stop at the equator. Well, it didn't. And in fact, it was Paul Mayevsky that proved that, because he found the record of Chernobyl at the South Pole. Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's very interesting.
It skipped the areas in between, but because of the way the magnetic flux of the Earth goes, it comes down at the South Pole, so
yeah.
It came up and down. But, yeah, I mean, if you, I use 630,000 years because that's the measurable. President Bush said, W. Bush, said that his people were saying it's just another cycle. Well, that did it. That generated an enormous amount of research that got the cycle back to 630,000 in the ice cores and the ocean cores, and there's no sign that the present day exacerbation of the CO2 level is anywhere to be seen in that record. Nothing like that until 1817, 70, 1750.
Right. Yeah.
And then, and now we've reached 400 parts per million in the atmosphere. It's as high as it's been since 3 million years ago. No. We're in trouble.
We can measure back to 3 million years?
Yeah, someone else came up with that figure recently. And
how would they...
I don't know how they did it.
Oh, okay.
I don't know, but that was it said we finally achieved the level of CO2 that we had 3 million years ago. And this is the first time we've done that. And the follow-through was that at that time, sea level was 20 or 30 feet higher than it is today, and the global temperatures were up to 20 degrees centigrade hotter than they are today. And if that's all right, then we've got the temperature set, that we've got the CO2 to do that. So the temperature is just going to go up. Everything's going to go with it.
Yeah.
We just haven't caught up with it yet, which is awfully scary.
It's certainly going to have a huge human impact in some parts of the world anyway.
But, you know, the other side of this, the glacial cycles, you get 100,000, these are driven by planetary positioning, but you got 100,000 years of ice conditions, then 10 to 15,000 of interglacial like this, and another 100,000, another 10, another 100. Where are we now? The ice disappeared
past the 10,
at
10.
We're now 10,000 years into the present interglacial. We've gone through the warm part of it. That was when the 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years ago when the Indians lived on the coast and big shell middens were formed and the oysters grew ubiquitously in the Gulf of Maine, swordfish all over the place. And now we're getting colder. So in spite of this global warming, we're on the way towards the next glaciation. And we're being, beyond that, I don't know. What are we going to do with that? There's been some suggestion that the present-day CO2 rise is the trigger for the next glacial period, because the global temperature is balanced by the great conveyor belt of water through the oceans of the world. It circulates warm water north to us and cold water south and keeps everything balanced. But if you shut off the Gulf Stream, then the north would get extremely cold and the south would get extremely warm. And that has happened. It's called the Younger Dryas period. It's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
You can prove it, and that it stopped it. And it was stopped by meltwater from the Northern Hemisphere. That is, finally, as the ice sheet melted back, the lakes that formed around the depressed margin had access to the St. Lawrence Valley system, and it went sloshing out into the northern, coated the North Atlantic with fresh water and stopped the Gulf Stream, because the Gulf Stream is driven by salt water getting increasingly more saline as it comes north on the surface through evaporation. And just that little bit of increased weight causes the cold water in the north to sink and runs back past the equator, comes up in the Antarctic convergence, comes back up again, bringing warm water to the north. So if you stop that by stopping the evaporation by putting fresh water all over the Northern Hemisphere, we stop the ice sheet and we're in another ice age. And that's the theory expressed in that movie called The
ice
Day After Tomorrow.
Yeah, I remember seeing
exactly
it.
That.
Although they had it happening in a
so,
day or something.
You know, so the more water we get in the, and that's what's happening. We're melting the Greenland ice sheet,
yeah,
and the North Atlantic is getting colder. And if it coats fresh water all over the surface and doesn't allow that fresh water to flit away down to the south and accumulates to the point where it really stops the Gulf Stream, we're in big trouble. But no one ever talks about
three.
This side of it. Yeah.
Yeah, I want to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know you
go.
Have something at three, so.
I've got an MRI of my back. I've got a lower back problem. I want to see what it looks like.
So thank you so much. This has been great. And I'm just going to ask you to sign the deposit agreement here, right there. I'll fill in the rest later. And thank you very much for
where?
On the left, on the right, where it says name of interviewee, right there. And that just allows me to deposit the recording in the Football Archives.
How long has this been around, this type of form?
Oh, a long time.
Is this something that San